This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 5th of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. This is your daily appointment with our international critics and cultural experts to find out the shows to see, books to read, and music to hear each week. Today, we'll be getting our noses stuck into a few of the latest non-fiction book releases with Parul Sehgal, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, including Helen MacDonald's much-praised memoir, H is for Hawk, Eric Larson's Dead Wake about the sinking of the Lusitania, and The Evil Hours by the former Marine David Morris, a delve into what it's like to deal with post-traumatic stress. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review, so stay tuned. Parul, welcome to the programme. Great to speak with you, as always, from our New York bureau. Let's perhaps look at I guess it's almost the new latest literary phenomenon of H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, published to sort of rapturous acclaim here in the UK last year. And now I gather getting the similar kind of response on the other side of the pond.
Yeah, this book is just irresistible to everyone, it seems. So it was published this week. It's already on the bestseller list. It's being called the first great breakout book of 2015. And again, it's somewhat surprising because this is a book that has a lot of darkness in it. It's a really unapologetically literary book. It's kind of feral. It's a grief memoir. And yet it's just absolutely, it's been greeted by rapturous acclaim.
Well, Parul, let me ask you about that exact point that you mentioned there, this grief memoir. People have said it's a misery memoir as well, using that alliterative terminology. Do you think there is something undeniably compelling, absorbing about these sorts of studies of melancholy, particularly in this case, studies of the grieving process? Because, of course, it's about the author's response to the death of her father, isn't it?
Well, sure. I mean, I think, you know, one way that we've always read these books and why tragedy is just important in the culture and in literature is just as this cathartic, it provides a sort of cathartic service. You know, we get to suffer alongside this author. We get a glimpse of, this kind of tragedy. We get to experience some of our own. But I think really what makes this book so special is the author's ability to sort of go to the extremes. You know, she's not just mourning the death of a beloved father. She is retreating from human society. She is going back to this old pastime that she had as a child, this sort of love of goshawks, this particularly beastly and bruiser of a hawk. And she's sort of, you know, enacting what I think a lot of people feel, which is just sort of how grief isolates us, how grief sort of removes us from civilization in a way. It's its own planet. And I think that this book, this misery memoir genre, sort of really encapsulates that.
Also, I guess, Parul, it's a story about, as you mentioned, a relationship between a human and an extraordinary creature. And there is a bit of a literary heritage, isn't there, of these unlikely sort of friendships between these strange animal companions. I don't know, the snow goose would be one example.
That's
and
right.
There's also something compelling, isn't there, about the human engagement with their sort of animal friends in that way.
Absolutely. You know, there's My Dog Tulip, there are books, all kinds of books like this. And in fact, she looks at T.H. White's book about also training a goshawk to sort of look at that bond. So, yeah, there's this idea of when, you know, we find ourselves most human when we're with animals sometimes, and sort of trying to draw those boundaries of where we are feral and where they are tame. And it's especially interesting in her case because I think she also is so deeply interested in demystifying what kind of human narratives have created this particular falcon, right? Because it's been associated with man for so long. It's been associated with a certain kind of barbarity and fear and hunting. And so she's also very interested in seeing the animal for itself, aside from some of those, like, you know, pulling apart some of those narratives and sort of just living with this little creature who she names Mabel. The beauty of this book is, yes, it's a misery memoir, but it's also so finely and tenderly observed. She knows the way that the hawk's breath smells. She knows it smells of pepper. She knows that when the hawk preens its feathers, it sounds like, I think she says, a deck of cards being shuffled. So you get this incredibly sort of tender love story in the middle of all of this suffering.
Well, let's actually hear a little of the book, Parul, now that this is a reading that actually expresses some of that relationship. It describes the relationship between the author and the falcon. Let's have a listen.
I sat at my computer in the rain-lit study. I telephoned friends. I wrote emails. I found a hawk breeder in Northern Ireland with one young goshawk left from that year's brood. She was 10 weeks old, half Czech, one quarter Finnish, one quarter German, and she was, for a goshawk, small. We'd arranged that I should drive to Scotland to pick her up. I thought that I would like to have a small goshawk. Small was the only decision I made. I didn't think for a second there was any choice in the matter of the hawk itself. The hawk had caught me. It was never the other way round.
A reading from H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. Peril, just on this finally, I mean, obviously Helen MacDonald is a terrific talent. You can hear there, you know, a beautiful writer, a beautiful manipulator of words. Sometimes people wonder whether with an incredibly powerful book like this, you know, a writer almost gives too much of themselves and then there's nowhere left for them to go. But one sense is that MacDonald is such a talent and there'll be plenty more exciting things from her in the future.
Oh, I hope so. I think her range is immense. I mean, she's also a poet. She's a historian. She's an immensely interesting critic, you'll also see in this book. So I think she's got kind of, you know, a sort of formidable scope. And I think that she can do, and I hope she'll do just about anything.
Now, talking of writers with incredible scope, and certainly a writer who has a tremendous love of the heavily researched historical novel, let's talk a little bit about Erik Larsson, a timely publication of his new book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania, just, what, a matter of weeks before the centennial of that event. Mm-hmm. I remember reading Erik Larsson's The Devil in the White City, which I thought was a terrific work. This is a real researcher's writer, isn't it? Someone who for whom historical detail is everything.
Detail is everything, but he's also got this gift of spinning it into these incredibly propulsive, suspenseful yarns. And he also has this great nose for sniffing out these amazing gothic stories in history and sort of finding these representative crimes or tragedies that tell us something about how a culture wants to see itself and how it really is. As you mentioned, like The Devil in the White City is this incredible book about a serial killer stalking the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. And it's this great sort of juxtaposition of, you know, man sort of showing how sophisticated we are and yet these sort of like base impulses at the heart of it. So this book, again, combines research, but, you know, there isn't as much original research in this book as there is pure storytelling. So if you've been, you know, and people become obsessed with the Lusitania, it's just one of those great maritime mysteries. So if you're somebody who knows a lot about it, you're not going to encounter necessarily new information in this book, Dead Wake, but what you're going to see is incredible scene setting. You're going to see an incredible evocation of life on the Lusitania, as well as, and this is, you know, what's most interesting to me, is life on the submarine, the German submarine that stalked it quietly and finally sank it in 1915.
Peril, tell us a little bit about the sort of narrative devices he uses, because I gather, you know, Larsson focuses in on this week that from the Lusitania's departure from New York City up until the famous disaster, of course. I mean, I guess one part of that is weaving these various strands, because it's quite expansive, isn't it, the sort of the ambit of the book. But does he also capture, as you say, you know, on board the submarine, that intensity, that the proximity, that idea of, the you know, stalking this ship? How does he weave these strands together?
Well, I think he's definitely a writer. Well, I have this strong certainty he reread Moby Dick while writing this book, because there is this fantastic feeling of Ahab stalking the great white whale, you know. But he also sort of gets how, you know, the commander in charge of this U-boat was sort of like inherently and oddly, you know, a very decent kind of guy who, you know, was forever rescuing dogs from sinking ships. Like, there were six dogs apparently the submarine at one point, and it was this terrible, like, sort of fetid, stinky place, but everybody was trying to decently do their work as best as they could, and this commander was trying to look after his men. So he gets you know, some of the drama, some of the suspense, but also just this human sort of very you know, occasionally very funny element. So there's some of that strategy at work. But yeah, there's so many questions, there's so many riddles that this ship has left in its wake. And I think one of the interesting things that he does is that he sort of preserves some of those mysteries. I think if you're a reader coming to this book, you can, you know, be left feeling a little frustrated. Well, why doesn't he solve, for example, there's this, you know, ongoing sort of question about the second explosion. The Lusitania was brought down by one torpedo in its hull, but a few seconds, I think it's like 18 seconds after, there was another explosion that ended that brought down the ship. So he gently sort of talks about different hypotheses, but never really quite answers the question, conclusively, which I think is a beautiful way of sort of acknowledging that this is this, you know, like Moby Dick, this fundamentally puzzling creature in our midst.
And Larson Perel has some quite sort of elegant narrative devices, doesn't he? I know in the famous film 12 Angry Men, as the scenes within that courtroom become more and more intense, the walls actually of the set were moved closer and closer together to up that feeling of pressure. And
I didn't know that.
And Larson does a similar device, doesn't he? As the disaster edges closer, the chapters get shorter and shorter and
that's
shorter.
Right.
He's a master of the pacing, isn't he?
That's right. I mean, he's also somebody I think that, you know, has thought a lot about what it means to read narratives of this sort and has thought a lot about what it means to write true crime. And he just has a lot of like the thriller writer's instincts for how we read. He's great at sort of like ending the chapter on a cliffhanger. But as I'm saying this, like he respects his reader. You don't feel like ever that you're being, you know, he's cheapening the event or he doesn't have a sense of the scope of the human life that was lost. You know, I think it was something like 1,200 people perished. He has all of that, but he also wants to provide you with a really delicious reading experience.
Let's move on, Perel, and look at another, well, a fairly testing reading experience, but also picks up on, war and its consequences, its aftermath, talking about David J. Morris's book, The Evil Hours. And this is looking at post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's interesting, isn't it? This is a kind of an area, a phenomenon perhaps, that was traditionally focused on at or immediately after the time of combat and then maybe forgotten about, but that seems to have changed in the last few generations, particularly in the US, and this book's maybe reflecting how important this is as a social and cultural issue these days.
Yeah, that's right. And this is a book, I mean, it sounds like unremittingly grim, right? Like PTSD, who wants to read an entire biography about that? Again, this is a book that has a sort of really interesting torque at its center. So the author, as you mentioned, was a former Marine, and he returned from Iraq and he returned from Fallujah, and he started to experience some of the symptoms of PTSD that we now understand, disassociation, he would lose track of time. There was a sort of heightened vigilance. And so he starts to investigate himself. What am I feeling? Why am I feeling this? Why is it so hard for me to get care? And then what he does, which is incredibly interesting, he goes back and studies how we've understood soldiers suffering from the time of Achilles. And the interesting thing is we really don't know very much about what trauma does to the mind and the body, especially when, you know, it comes to soldiers. So, you know, as you say, there's always right after wars a brief flurry of interest. Right after World War I, we saw some interest in sort of understanding what shell shock did. Or after World War II, and specifically after Vietnam, we started to understand that there is this thing called PTSD. But, you know, concerted efforts to treat and understand what happens to people after war or any kind of violent crime have been few and far between. There really aren't any drugs that have been proven useful in treating PTSD. And so he sort of, you know, part of the book is to sort of look at why this has been so hard to understand, why this has been so hard to treat. And then, you know, this through line of sort of what's happening to me gives it this sort of richer, more intimate dimension.
Perel, it's interesting. I know we talked a little bit about Moby Dick earlier, and I know that there was a psychiatrist who spoke to Morris and said that one of the central images of post-traumatic stress disorder happens at the end of that book. Ishmael is floating on the coffin, staring at the vastness of the ocean. Is this a book that then manages to weave those clinical elements with a literary sensibility as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to, because there have been, and there's this complete paucity really of scientific research about trauma, but the people that have been studying trauma, especially post-war trauma, have always been the novelists and the poets. And he goes back and kind of, you know, asks, you know, is the Odyssey this long PTSD narrative, right? After the Iliad, Odysseus can't get home, he can't get right. So, I mean, he doesn't do this in a reductive way, but what he does do is he looks at Ford Madox Ford, and he looks at Virginia Woolf, and he looks at all of these incredible sort of accounts of suffering to try to understand what's been missed.
Perel, let me ask you, you went to pains at the start to say, you know, this is not a book about, you know, it's not a clinical text, it's not a book just about the trauma, it's not an unremittingly grim read. Do you think it's a book that would help, I don't know, modern American readers in particular to understand, you know, their country in the aftermath of contemporary conflicts, in the aftermath of 9/11? Does it have perhaps a, I don't know, a wider function than just an understanding of the condition?
Absolutely. That's a really good point. He actually talks about, you know, for America, he calls it aftermath culture, that there are ways after 9/11. He looks at, you know, helicopter parenting, for example, this term for parents who are incredibly overly invested and anxious about their children and sort of choreographing their daily activities. So he asks, is this a function, right? Is the entire culture in this kind of hangover after 9/11 and we're just frightened and we don't understand? But plus, he also looks at the way that some people are looking at PTSD, particularly this psychologist named David Shea, I think, who makes it very central to treating soldiers to acknowledge guilt and to say that one of the reasons PTSD is so unshakable and so tricky and painful is that it's actually, for some soldiers and some people, a rational response to a, you know, horrifying situation, and you do horrible things and you come back, he says, morally your conscience has injuries. So how do we talk about that? And to your point, you know, one of the reasons maybe American culture has such a problem talking about PTSD and you know, soldier suffering is that the society itself hasn't fully reconciled the consequences of these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Parul Sehgal, editor at the New York Times Book Review, discussing The Evil Hours by David J. Morris. Thank you very much for joining us here on the programme. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. Tomorrow we'll be joined by our very own queen of the silver screen, Karen Krasanovich. But for now, thanks for listening.